Hi there, this is Emily Williams, Disability Advisor for the Diocese of Leicester, and you're listening to the Disability in the Church podcast, a place where I chat to different guests all about disability inclusion within the Christian Church. I hope this will be a place where we can learn together, make mistakes together, and spark new ideas together. This episode was recorded remotely during the UK lockdown, therefore the sound quality might not be as good as normal, but the content is still fab. Let's get started. Welcome back to my podcast. It's great to have you. Today I'm joined by Chris Hamewood, who I've only actually met in virtual form via email or on Zoom as a result of the first series of the podcast. Chris, it was so lovely for you to get in touch. I loved receiving your email. Could you just introduce yourself?
So first of all, Emily, I'd really like to say how touched and honoured I was to be asked to be a part of this podcast. I engaged with it as a punter, someone who wanted to learn, not thinking that I had anything to contribute. So I was really touched that you got in touch with me and said, look, I think you've got some interesting experiences. You might want to be involved. So I'm really delighted to be involved. Thank you for that. But I'm a curate in Huggleskoke Parish with Donington, Leheath, Ellistown and Snibson in northwest Leicestershire, in the western spiral arm of Leicester Diocese, as I call it, right up there in the north, in the northwest corner of Leicester Diocese. And I've been here just coming up to 4 years as doing my curacy. My curacy is just about to come to an end and I'm about to move on. But we really love being in this area of northwest Leicestershire, not least because my wife and I are very keen walkers. We have a dog and we love dog walking and getting out and about. And this is a quite a hidden and beautiful part of the world. The Charnwood Forest is not well known, but it is beautiful. Mm-hmm. And so we love walking our dog, Archie. It's like say in the forest. I'm a keen photographer as well, so I love doing some landscape photography out and about. So lockdown has enabled us to indulge that, because one of the things that we've been allowed to do is to get out and walk. So we walk. I've actually lost 2 stone in weight over lockdown walking my dog. So that's
good for you. Yeah, we did similar because all you could do was walk. We suddenly found that our dog walks went from sort of 45 minutes to 2-3 hour walks.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because that's all you can do.
Absolutely, yeah, no, that's exactly what we've been doing. So when we've had a day off, we thought, well, how do we do this? Well, we'll go out for a good long walk.
So I mentioned before that you got in touch having listened to the first series. How did you come about it, out of interest?
So I picked up on it through Diomel, the Leicester Diocese, say weekly e-newsletter that comes out, and I think I sort of read a piece on it in there, and naturally picked up on it because I have an interest in disability issues. I'm sure we'll talk about it in the podcast, but I have a background in the NHS working with people with disabilities, but just an awareness that we have more to learn here. And I was noticing some of the names and people thought, oh, actually, I really respect those people, and they're really interesting. With Roy McCluffley particularly is someone that I was picked up on, have read a number of his books, and so very engaged in his writing. So I thought, well, let's have a listen to that, and was really impressed with the approach, and the honesty, and the integrity, and how you took on some of the issues, but did it sensitively and appropriately.
Thank you so much, and that's what I want. That's what I want for this, really. And I think I say at the beginning, like, that it's a friendly space to make mistakes together and learn together. And I love that that's what it did for you. Thank you for sharing.
And it was exactly that. It was the friendly space that where we learn together and make mistakes together, and approach those in the spirit of continual and open learning. That's where I'm at, and that's where your podcast is centered around. And it was that really engaged me and enthused me about it, really.
Well, it's a field that we're all always learning in, aren't we? This podcast has become almost like a hobby for me, because I now get to invite people to chat to that I want to learn from. And so you're listening to me learning, essentially, when you're listening to the podcast. I love that it can be a place we can all learn together, because no one has all the answers. So you're coming to the end of your curacy and you're going to be starting your incumbency soon. For people that aren't aware of the word incumbency, that's becoming a vicar.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So,
lingo.
So I was ordained in Leicester Diocese just nearly 4 years ago and took up a curacy position in northwest Leicestershire. We had a very strong sense of call to Northwest Leicestershire. I remember my wife speaking to someone shortly after we started here. They said, "Oh, where are you, you know, doing ministry in Leicester?" And they said, "Oh, you know, we're in Leicester, in Northwest Leicestershire, near, you know, near Colville." And the person said, "Oh, why did you go there?" And my wife said, "Well, my wife almost spat back, because we were called." A very strong sense of call to this, these people, this community, this place. So it's been a real privilege to serve my curacy in Northwest Leicestershire with the people of Huggleskirk and Ellisdown, which Snibsom and Donington and Heath. You have to include them all. but we would want to include them all because they are all part of our community. And a key part of my ministry here has been very incarnational. It's been about being involved in the community, being present in the community. We took the very intentional decision of locating us in Ellisdown, where we didn't have a presence. There is a church here, but there wasn't a vicar living here. You know, the rector lives in Huggleskirk. So being here and being a part of our community has been really, really important. One of the things that we do that I got involved with early is we do, I'll tell this story here, is a community cinema. So I think they have one at Ratley, and that's the sort of model that we followed. So, but we have a sort of community cinema where we put on, we've got some state-of-the-art film equipment for our church, and we put up a screen and we do have the projector, and we put on a film for free for the community, and they come in and they sit in the church and they watch. We have a tuck shop and refreshment.
Nice.
And it was very clear that very early on that there was one family that was coming, a mother and I think three children. And one of the children was profoundly physically and mentally disabled, coming in a wheelchair. And they could come in and all enjoy the film, and it would be a big family outing. And then on the way out, I engaged the mother and said, "Oh, it's really great that you're able to come." And she said, "Oh, this is really important for us. It's the only place we can come as a family. And I can't go to normals. You know, I can't go to normal cinemas." I said, "Oh, well, why not?" And she said, "Oh, well, one, it's the expense. There's four of us and it takes a lot of money. Yeah. But two, whenever I take my son, he shouts and cries out in the film and they ask us to leave." And I said, "We don't only encourage you to come. We celebrate that sort of response. That is what we are here to do. If your son cries out and enjoys the film, that is what we celebrate." And you know, cinema is a community event. People shout out. They, you know, in movies, they woo and ah and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Of course, why wouldn't you do that?
Yeah.
And so it was a really important, and our facilities were quite compromised. It was quite a challenge to, you know, to be able to accommodate that, you know, that whole situation, the wheelchair through the door and changing position, all the rest of it. But we tried to go out of our way to make that a really affirming experience for the whole family,
right,
to enjoy the film together. And with all the challenges that was, and for the whole church community, or the whole community beyond the church, to enjoy the film together and celebrate that, and for that not to be an issue.
Yeah. And you know, for you and your team, potentially that was, you know, a decent chunk of work to facilitate that family being able to come, but actually for that parent, they got to have a family evening out and all together got to sit with all of her kids, and they got to watch a film at the same time, all together with everybody else in the community, all with their little tuck shop bags. And they just got to do what everyone else does without even thinking about it. And why shouldn't they be able to do that? That's
absolutely
so important, isn't it, to facilitate that.
And then the narrative goes round. Is that family go away and said, "You know what? That church went to a lot of effort to make sure we could be included." That is a story of the kingdom of God.
Uh-huh.
And we're not the ones putting it out there. That family is doing the evangelism of the kingdom of God. Mm-hmm. They are telling a narrative about us, which is a powerful narrative.
Well, because in that evening, in that moment, you loved them as Jesus loved them, and you welcomed absolutely them, and you enabled them to be there as Jesus would.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Now, if we pause on vicaring, before vicaring, you worked in the NHS, correct?
Right, yeah.
What was that?
So from a very young age, I wanted to do something in the caring profession. So my wife is watching the reruns of All Creatures Great and Small, but I can't bear myself to watch the new ones because I used to like the old ones so much. But I became a vet because I love animals. But that wasn't going to be possible. I wasn't academically good enough to be a vet. So I looked at doing something in healthcare, and my mother, who used to see a podiatrist and had bad feet, said, well, why don't you become a podiatrist, or chiropodist, as they were called at the time. Yeah. So I thought, well, why not? And I looked at it, and I something drew me to that profession. I don't know what it was. I mean, it's feet. I mean, I don't know why you'd be attracted to feet. but something drew me to that profession. It was only some time afterwards, when you looked, someone said life has to be viewed backwards to be understood going forwards. Yeah. And when I looked back, that I realised what it was that attracted me to that, really. So I trained to become a podiatrist or chiropodist. We changed the name to podiatrist because it's in the Greek, it's more accurate. Podo means foot, and is practitioner of, whereas chiropodist is hands and feet, and we don't do hands anymore.
Ah.
So it's podoist. So I trained to become a podiatrist, and it was this sense. So with podiatry, you do a small intervention. You do something that's 20 minutes. It's just a small intervention that makes a massive difference to someone's life. They walk in pain and with difficulty and struggling, and they go out comfortable and able to to live their life. And there's a measurement in healthcare called a quality measurement, which is the quality of output for the quality of input or the amount of input. And okay. Podiatry is near the top of that because it's a very low cost input, but with a very high output. You enable people to go and live a life that they want to. And the other thing with podiatry is so that attracted me. Mm-hmm. The other thing with podiatry is you're working with people for the long term, is they come back. So you build a relationship and you work with a patient over a period of time to manage and hopefully address their problem, moving them from so one of the last patients I saw in a clinic, I did some private work towards the end of my career just to finish off, and a lady was coming in. She needed to come in and see us every 2 weeks for treatment. And I said, right, you're with me. So that's one of the things I learned: take responsibility for patient, reassure them that you're going to get involved with them. Get involved with the situation, and we worked sort of every 2 weeks, and it moved to 3 weeks, and it started to go to 4 weeks, and because that makes a big difference to someone's life that they can go 4 weeks without treatment, they can live a life. And she had no idea that I was going off to train to be a vicar, and she was the last patient I saw. She went out the door, she turned to me and she said, you know, you've been an absolute angel to me. And it meant a lot, because that's what we do, is we work with someone and we're involved in their lives. Involved in their healthcare and enables them to live the life that they want to live, and that's what attracted me to the profession, I think, and that sense of working with someone and really helping them in their life circumstances has bigger impact than just their feet. So I started as a clinical podiatrist and then worked my way through the ranks to become a specialist. I'm sure we'll pick up on this in a little while. A specialist in rheumatology and physical disabilities. And then I went into service management and did some governance work as well for the organisations I was involved with, but particularly.
So you do have like a medical background in the disability area.
Yeah, so podiatry is a paramedical profession like nursing or physiotherapy, that sort of area. So I'm not a doctor.
Yeah.
But you're going to go a basic a medical training. That's pertinent or relevant to your field. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And you mentioned to me previously you set up some sort of, or you were part of a rehab centre for individuals with disabilities.
Yeah, it was a really exciting part of my career. So I took a job at Wandsworth Community Health Trust, as it was at the time, and what's at the time called a senior podiatrist, a sort of more senior position. And they we were quite forward thinking in putting together a community rehabilitation unit for people with physical disabilities. That was it was specific remit. And even more forward thinking in having a podiatrist involved in that setup, just to see if there was a role for a podiatrist in that sort of work. Okay. And for a lot of it, there wasn't a role for a podiatrist in that sort of work. But for some, there was. I remember seeing patients with multiple sclerosis, with MS. And they come in classically with very flat feet because they lose muscle tone and they lose muscle strength and they get very flat feet. Right. And I thought, oh, I wonder if I could just do something to support their feet and make their walking a bit more efficient. So I started making them insoles and supporting their feet, the same as we would do for sportsmen and women and that sort of thing. And I was quietly doing my thing, not really telling anyone because I didn't want, just wanted to see if it worked. And then the physio started coming back to me and saying, what are you doing with our patients? I said, well, I'm sorry. He said, no. They see you and then they come back and then they're four times better at walking. I'm like, really? Yeah, we could do much better rehabilitation. It's like, oh. And so we were just learning where open access could be involved, how we related to other professions, and how we, how by working together, working collaboratively, and working with the patient, allowing the patient to determine what they wanted to do, to get better outcomes, to enable people to live lives that were much more along the lines of what they wanted to do. So we went for a big shift of the health service used to do for, we know better, the doctor knows best, we'll do for, this is what we'll do, and then we'll measure it like this. We'll see how long it takes you to walk 100 meters, or how long it takes you to boil a kettle and that sort of thing. You know, are you safe in a kitchen? And yeah. And the patient started saying, no, we want someone else to dress us. We want to go out and party. We want to go out and meet our friends.
Love it. I want to live.
Yeah, I want to live. And so the model of care started changing, which where it was much more patient-centered, goal-setting, we'll call it. The patient determined the outcome that they wanted to achieve. And then we worked with them to achieve that outcome. And what we found was very quickly, and it's well established now in healthcare, is that we were able to achieve far more than actually our expectations were limiting. So there was a very famous story of a patient we had, quite a young patient who had a stroke. And they said to him, what do you want to be able to achieve? He said, I want to go back to playing tennis. He was quite a good club, a very good club tennis player, I think, or even county tennis player. So I want to go back to playing tennis. And the physio said to him, no chance. You're never going to go back to playing tennis. Forget it. But they did some rehabilitation work with him, and he kept saying, I want to go back to playing tennis. And so, well, on one occasion, his physio was seen going through the office in a tennis gear, swinging a tennis racket. So I'm going to go and play tennis. So this will show him. She come back an hour later, having been absolutely whooped. the ball had whistled past her, and he didn't go back to playing competitive tennis, but he went back to playing club tennis, and we all went to watch him play his first game of doubles with his mates, and his friends were just lobbing the ball back to him over the net, and it was whistling back whenever it was in his sphere. Yeah. He could just whack it because he got the technique.
I love that, like you just said, that actually our opinions, our thoughts, presumptions were limiting said individuals. I think that's a really important part thing that you just said to pick up on, that actually our presumptions are limiting individuals, and that's not fair. That's not cool.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And enabling people to set their own agendas.
Yeah.
And then to work towards them means that one, it makes more motivating for everyone involved, much more interesting. So as I got involved in physical disabilities, I moved towards rheumatology. So that was where there's a very specific remit for podiatrists, because the active inflammation, rheumatoid arthritis, those sorts of conditions are very actively affected. There's a lot of joints in the feet. They're very, very disabling. So I saw very early in my career, very early in my involvement, that someone said, well, just see this lady. She's a barrister. She's got rheumatoid arthritis. She can't do a job. She can't stand in court because her feet are just too painful. And it was really important that she was a barrister, a professional, quite forceful, really, as they tend to be. And I saw her, I thought, I don't know what to do here. And I just made her this soft cushioning insole and tried to keep her comfortable. And she came back. I explained to her what was going on and what we were doing, the reasoning, involved the patient in the... So a lot of my job was education, talking to people about what was going on.
Yeah.
Involved them so they're empowered and enabled. And she came back and she said, yeah, this insole has helped, but it's not good enough. You can do better. I was like, oh, okay. So we tried something else. And again, she comes, that's better again, but still not good enough. And we've moved up from this soft cushioning insole. She said, I felt like I want something to control my feet, to really change the way they function. And we made it this hard, rigid. So it's made out of a bulletproof vest and stealth bombers and that sort of thing. And we made it this really hard, rigid device. I thought, this isn't going to work with a really tenderly painful foot. But she came back and said, that's done it, because it was about controlling the way the foot works and unloading the painful joints, not just cushioning it. And it changed the whole paradigm, because we had a patient that was working with us, who we'd involved with us and spoke back to us and said, look, let's work together on this. We not only changed the treatment and outcome for that lady, but for everyone subsequently. And a friend of mine was doing some research at the same time, and I rang him and said, look, am I okay to do this? He said, yeah, this is what we're finding in the research. And so it changed the whole paradigm.
Yeah. So take the specifics of NHS out of that, the actual theory of, you know, chatting with the individual, with the family, whatever it is, and working together, they're the experts, they know what they need, they know what they can feel, they know what they're not coping with or what they're struggling with, and you know your environment, and so work together to trial and error until you find what works really well. And so that's what you guys pioneered in that, and that at that whatever year that was in the NHS field.
And it's actually, 20 years ago,
yeah, and it's completely transferable today to our church settings. I must say that in every single podcast episode is chat with the individual and work together.
There was another lovely story about, so often you're not dealing with the physical, often you're dealing with the emotional.
This podcast and other resources are created voluntarily to help encourage churches to become more accessible to those with disabilities. Emily would love to give more to her role as disability advisor. One simple way to support her in this is to visit buymeacoffee.com/Emily Williams. Essentially, you donate the cost of a brew from your local coffee shop. You can even commit to it monthly. That's buymeacoffee.com/Emily Williams. Thank you for any support you can give.
Dealing with the emotional. Mm-hmm. There was a lady I saw with crippling rheumatoid arthritis, I think she had. And I said, look, how can we help you? She said, every day I go to pick up my kids from school and I have to sit in my car and watch them come out, and they come out of the school and they get in the back seat of the car and I drive home because my feet are too painful to stand outside the school gate. And I sit there watching the other parents chatting and talking and laughing with each other. And I see the children run out and throw their arms around their parents and show them what they've been doing that day.
Oh.
And my kids come and sit in the back of the car. I want you to help me to stand at the school gate. So I threw the kitchen sink at that. I was like, right, rolled up my sleeves, we'll get stuck in here. And
yeah, parent, that really.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm filling up, like.
Yeah, it was a really emotional one for me. And so we did a lot of work, and then she said, I'm able to do that now, and off she went. And I didn't see her, say in the clinic again. She, you know, we've got so far, they're always able to come back, but we've got so far as we could at that time. But I was in Brighton at the time, and Brighton was the sort of place where you bumped into people. And I remember one Friday, I'd had a Friday off, and I dropped my wife at work and then dropped the car at the garage and was walking home. And as I walked home, I saw this lady coming down the street with three children, and she was struggling with them, but not struggling with them because she had painful feet, struggling with them because they were three kids that she was trying to get to school. And I thought, well, she clocked me as I've clocked her. I didn't want to sort of jump in on that space.
Yeah, yeah.
But just as I went past, she winked at me.
And it was
here is a lady who we have restored some modicum of normal life back for. Yeah. If normal life, perhaps in inverted commas, because what is normal? But she was able to be with those other parents doing that normal parent thing. And that was really important.
I think the learning point that I take from things like that is, like, what do I take for granted? Just this morning, I drove my son to nursery and stood at the front gate, because we're not allowed in right now because of COVID, and waited for him to be collected. And then I came home and I've come back to work. I will go to church on Sunday when communion is back to communion. I will go and take communion. I will sing when it's time to sing. I will join the choir when I want to join the choir. And actually, what is it that we take for granted that, as you know, as able-bodied, for want of a better word, individuals, we can just get on with and do and not even think about, that every single person has a right to do, and they can do it with some, yep, with some tweaks, with some alterations, with some support. Everyone can do that kind of thing. But as you say, it just takes working with that individual to be like, right, what do you need from me? What can I do? What can we do together to achieve this?
Mm. Just picking up on something you said earlier. So when I knew I was doing this podcast, I spoke to some friends of mine, some friends from theological college, who have got three children and then adopted two more, both with disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done amazingly. And when I say that they adopted the children, they didn't. The whole family adopted, and the whole community adopted the children. But their narrative has been regular, and it grieved me every time that they've gone and had this experience in the NHS, is will you listen to us and our experience and work with us? And they regularly come up against people that think they know best for them. But actually the narrative has been, can you listen to us and listen to our child and allow them to tell their story and allow them to say what their passions and what they would like and how they would like things to be. And so that learning of listening and really understanding where someone is and engaging with that, start using that as a starting point and allowing the person to share their expertise is something I've very much taken into ministry from my NHS years.
I find that these families, these individuals can have such giftings and so much to bring to your church family that frankly, if they weren't there, there'd be a hole. And they're such an integral part, as I am, as you are, and they have their own ingredients to bring to this family. And it's really important that they're there. And there are so many churches with that hole right now still. And we need to facilitate that them to come, because they're an integral part of that community and they have value to bring.
So the really important story to tell there, so it's my wife's story, but she's given me permission to share it. She did a year in Hong Kong caring, it's in her home, caring for people with physical disabilities. And it was an old school missionary and an old school home approach where these are adults, but they were called children. And my wife was uncomfortable with that, calling adults children. Yeah. It's an old school, it was an old school approach. But it was very much an old school missionary, you know, hair in a bun and flyaway glasses and that sort of thing. The people that lead it were amazing, but doing pioneer work. But it was very much we care for them.
Yeah.
And these people are, you know these. That was the approach. And my wife, while she was there, had a series of really, right, because it was by letter then, but received a series of letters telling her bereavements of family back home. She lost, I think, three of her four grandparents. And of course, as an 18-year-old girl in a different place, in that sort of amount, she was tremendously upset.
Yeah, of course.
And the people at the home were reasonably supportive, but didn't really engage with Georgie emotionally and really, no. The people that picked up on it were the people she was caring for. Mm-hmm. Intuitively, they knew Georgie was upset and they reached out with a touch and an expression. Mm-hmm. And a word. And my wife speaks powerfully of how she was ministered to by those people that you'd think have no capacity to do that, but actually had the most wonderful capacity to do that.
Yeah.
Because they intuitively pick up on those communications because that's, they don't have words or don't have hearing. And it's, I think it's a powerful, it's a powerful narrative for what you're saying, really, is that we underestimate the capacity of people with disabilities to contribute. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm even uncomfortable using the word disabilities there, but to contribute and to contribute wonderfully in a way that enriches and fulfills us and enhances who we can be as the community of faith, as a Christian community, as the kingdom of God.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. I'm interested to know, in your vicar training, was there much disability awareness inclusion stuff? And my husband is currently training, he's just about to finish his ordination training, and I know he said they've had quite a lot on the BAME side of inclusion, which is obviously incredibly important, but I guess being married to me, he's very aware he's not necessarily had that much disability stuff. Maybe because he's married to me, he's always going to think he doesn't get enough of that kind of stuff. But I'm interested to know, like, what kind of stuff was touched on in your training? And
yeah, I'm going to try not to be controversial here. So, because you can look me up in conference, you'll know that it will tell you that I went to Cranmer Hall in Durham. And Cranmer Hall in Durham for my theological training was a wonderful place to be. We really loved being in the Northeast. We really loved. We really loved Durham, and Cranmer was a very rich theological education. But we had what they call Diversity Week. Excuse me a minute. So we had Diversity Week, where they go through a series of inclusion and diversity issues. And I've done quite a lot of that sort of stuff in my health service career. We had, disability awareness and that sort of thing all the time in my NHS career. But my observation of that training is we spent, I think, 2.5-3 days on race issues and race awareness, racial awareness. Mm-hmm. Which, don't get me wrong, as I completely agree, is a really, really important agenda for the church and for us.
Yeah, of course.
And there is a big issue about that glass ceiling and people not being able to go through to positions of leadership from the BAME background. But we spent a morning on disability issues. Mm. And my reflection was, it's just not enough. Mm. It's at least important as racial awareness, yeah. At least. And it you know, for some parishes, it would be much more of a touchstone issue for them in the church. Mm. And that's not say that the BME agenda isn't an important issue for us to be dealing with, but disability awareness is at least as important.
Yeah.
And inclusion and how we deal with this. So, but we did at least have some. We had this morning, and we were very say lucky to have or fortunate to have the Reverend Dr. Sally Nelson, who's a Baptist tutor at the St. Barnabas Theological Centre, come and speak to us on disability issues, on disability awareness and inclusion. And it was, I remember on my ordination retreat at Lorne Abbey before I was ordained, I sat there in one of the rooms, writing letters to the people that have been important to me in my life up to that point, that have brought me to the point of ordination. And the first letter I wrote was to Dr. Sally Nelson and said, thank you, because it was the best lecture that we had at Cranmer by nothing. She spoke honestly and openly. She modelled inclusion. She engaged us in a way that was, you know, as co-learners on this journey. Mm-hmm. Engaged us with the issues. We explored disability issues and issues about being made in the image of God and what that meant, and spoke about some of the experiences that she'd had that were difficult, and how the church needs to rethink some of its theology and approach. And if we have an issue in the church, and we do, with there being a glass ceiling for BAME people to progress through and into positions of leadership, we certainly have that issue for people with disabilities.
Oh, 100%. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but I would say you could probably, if you were high enough up, you could probably list the names of collared individuals, because there won't be nearly enough.
I wear hearing aids. I have some hearing loss. I lost a hearing aid recently. I flicked it out with my I took my mask off and it flicked it out. But it was in my better ear, so I didn't notice it had gone until it's too late. I couldn't find it.
No.
It was only then I realised, actually, I don't describe myself as disabled really, but I found out how disabling it was really. So I've had to find an old hearing aid and put it in, and it does the job adequately whilst they send me a new one. Yeah. But after I finished my training, that they put me through some specific medical interviews to make sure I was able to do my job with reasonable adaptations with hearing aids. And that was like, you know, in many ways, I'm really glad we're having this discussion, but it needs to be a discussion, not a we're assessing you and we will decide.
Yeah, it needs to be how capable are you? It needs to be a what support do we need to put in place
Absolutely.
For you?
That's
two very different conversations, isn't it?
Absolutely. So I was really glad for that training at Cranmer, that input, and for raising our awareness. And we have a very strong theology of inclusion on the BAME agenda of emotional awareness. Clearly, there's no Jew nor Greek, etc. But we have a very strong theology of inclusion inclusion in the kingdom of God of people with disabilities and a whole spectrum of humanity. Mm. And part of the theology of the church that we need to grapple is this idea of, so one of the things these friends of mine say with their disabled children is, it's very difficult when people come up to them and say, can we pray for your child that they'll be healed? And I see your wince there, and we wince together on that, and it's right that we wince together, because we need to have a theology that, okay, clearly there is healing, that Jesus is the great healer, but we need to modify our theology about what it means to be healed. Mm. and what it means to be created in the image of God, what it means to be a child of God. I heard this wonderful story that was told as part of my training of a webinar where there was a lady speaking on the webinar who was deaf and dumb, as the phrase goes. And she was talking about how she'd had this sort of vision, this encounter with Jesus in heaven. And she said, I was talking with Jesus in heaven, and we were talking, and she was talking about all these things. And it was a really interesting theology that they were engaging with, the things that she was saying through a translator, through signing. And at the end, she said, and of course, Jesus signed beautifully. And the leader said, hang on a minute. What do you mean he signed beautifully? Could you not speak in heaven? She said, no, I'm still deaf and dumb. He signed. And suddenly the perception of heaven is changed. Heaven isn't the place we've all sort of turned into someone that we're not, mm-hmm. that we're suddenly given, you know, speech if we didn't have speech. Heaven is a place where there is no barrier to communication, that we are all facilitated and enabled to communicate and converse and to share and to be together and to be a loving community of the people of God. Mm-hmm. Here is a bigger vision of heaven, a bigger vision of church that we need to take on board and grapple with and seek to live out and work out in our current church here on earth.
Yeah, I think the whole healing thing is it's a touchy place for me. I don't necessarily feel I'm equipped enough to really talk about it right now, but I will say I have met so many people that you know, wouldn't want to be healed in the traditional sense, that for example feel that their Down syndrome is a really important part of their person and brings such value that they don't want to be healed from it, or that I could give other examples, but you understand what I mean. And I hear the phrase is that there's a real difference between healing and cure, and yeah, it's that culture of enabling that I think is important instead of focusing on this healing, especially the presumption of healing, I think, is where I'm at. But as I say, I don't really feel like I'm equipped to talk about that, but you're definitely right in that there needs to be an awareness around that, for sure.
And it's valuing them for the person that they are. Not trying to turn them into something that they're not. So there's a lovely story I love telling in our church in Brighton. We had a lady with Down syndrome there, and she's very musical, as they tend to be, and we had a guitarist playing the guitar, and she picked up one of the banners that the children use and was waving this banner rhythmically to the music. Mm. And it was really moving. Everyone was really moved, and the guitarist was moved by it, and he closed his eyes and continued to play, and she went and stood behind him waving this banner, and the whole church was caught up in this worship that she was really facilitating and enabling. And it was this wonderful experience. Then suddenly, before anyone knew what was happening, she'd sat down behind the drum kit. this poor guitarist had no idea what was about to happen. And then as he finished, she went, dum. And you know what? We all laughed. Yeah. And it was okay to all laugh, because it was. And then for the rest of the service, her brother-in-law tried to prize her off the drum kit. We couldn't get her off. But the person next to me was literally on the floor laughing. It was such a wonderful moment. But it was a time we celebrated together.
Yeah, and she was caught up in worship, and
absolutely.
Oh, how delightfully freeing to just worship like that, and to enable everyone else in that congregation to just be free and to worship and to dance with the Lord, like.
Absolutely.
And that's the value and the gifting that she can bring.
Absolutely.
Yeah, amazing.
Absolutely.
So do you feel that your NHS background is where you have had quite a lot of disability experience, I suppose, even if it is a few years ago? Do you feel that shapes your approach to ministry now?
I think it, so you only realise how much your profession gives you when you move on from it, I think, and look back. And when you enter into it, when you're ordained and you go into ministry, there's a lot of period of reflection. So there's some things that my NHS career has given me, which are obviously like communication skills, being able to speak with people and listen and work with. And things like conflict transformation. I realised that every single patient consultation is potentially a conflict. You know, they come in and your treatment's not worked, like that lady I spoke about earlier, come in and said your treatment wasn't good enough. And so all the time you're learning those skills. And I'm very grateful for all those skills that it's given me, sort of, you know, even some practical skills like skills in risk, you know, risk assessment, although I sort of always keep that under under a bushel when I'm in PCC meeting.
Don't publicise that you can do those.
So I have a long background in governance. And so all those things are very helpful. But most importantly, I think, is this sense of working with. So as I said earlier, the reason I became a podiatrist was this working with someone in the long term. Mm-hmm. And my principal gifting in my ministry is discipleship, is discipling. And you're working with people in the long term and allowing them to, where the person is the starting point, and allowing them to determine and helping to facilitate, enable to, you know, them to determine how they will go on in their discipleship, how will they will go on becoming Christ-like and living the Christ, the life that Christ purposes for them. And facilitating and enabling and equipping that. And that is definitely something that's come from my NHS background, that approach to ministry, that heart and that passion. And allowing people to make the connections themselves. I remember being in a Lent course and people were speaking about prophecy and all sorts of different perspectives. And there was a bit of an argument going on about it. But I said, hang on a minute, all these perspectives are valuable. You're looking at behind the text, you're looking in front of the text, you're wondering how it's relevant to you now. All these perspectives are valuable. If we work together, we can have a much deeper understanding and this passage can be really enriching, informative to us. So it's about enabling them, enabling insight into what they were doing. They're actually doing quite sophisticated theology. They just didn't know it. So I see my input there is just to enable people, to affirm people. I think affirming people is fundamentally important. Telling them, thanking them and appreciating them and being specific. There was a guy, I spoke to him yesterday actually in our church, who did the prayers, intercessors. We have amazing intercessors at church. And so that's the first or second Sunday in the church. I said to him, thank you for your prayers this morning. They're absolutely incredible. And they were good because they did this. They related the passage to our context and then you prayed into it. And this is a big sort of burly sort of blokey bloke. And he started crying. I said, oh, I'm sorry, have I said something that's upsetting? He said, no, he said, but no one's ever thanked me like that before. They thanked him before, but not thanked him specifically. He said, I've been up half the night working specifically to try and do that. Oh. And you've identified that that's what I've done. And it meant the world to him. Mm. And so I think that's a really important part of my ministry, is definitely comes from my NHS background, identifying where people have achieved and really celebrating that and saying, let's celebrate who we are and how we are and really identify our giftedness in one another, really identify the potential that we have and affirm that. And that's definitely come from my NHS background. It definitely comes from working with people with rheumatoid arthritis who often have a struggle, but who with raising their horizons and the expectations that we could achieve far more. And that was always an enriching experience.
Thank you so much for chatting, Chris. It's been great to hear about your previous career and how that's kind of played in. And it's just been lovely to kind of share stories and anecdotes together. Thank you. And listeners, thank you for listening. And we will speak soon.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Disability in the Church podcast. For more information about the topics discussed today, then you can head to the Diocese of Leicester website and search Disability Resources for Churches. Thanks for listening, and be sure to join us next time. Bye!